So welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. This podcast is sponsored by the Masters of Journalism program at the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. Master Journalism, gain real-world experience in the media capital of the Pacific Rim, Los Angeles. Visit annenberg.usc.edu for more information. And joining me from a very waterlogged New York City, Rafat Ali. How are you doing, Rafat?
Hey, Mark. We've been better. It's been an overwhelming week for everybody here, really, and I think things are slowly but very slowly getting back to normal. But I think the biggest part right now in the city, at least New York City, is the transport, which is still pretty much a mess. So I think that's going to take a few days to get around. Then a lot of people still don't have electricity in the city, and of course all around in the tri-state area as well. I mean, in fact, in our company Skift, we are five people, and the only one that has electricity is me, and all four of them don't.
So what about your office? Does your office have electricity or not?
Yeah, so the office was near Times Square. So it's, as I'm sure you and everybody else has heard, it's almost like it's a complete divide between 34th Street and up in New York City, and then 34th Street and down in New York City, where electricity and all kinds of other issues are still there. So our office is on 37th to 38th, so we're fine. But I can't reach the office easily, at least. So I'm just working from home.
Right, because there's no way to get into Manhattan from like the different subway tunnels and everything. And I guess you could get in through cars about the only way.
Yeah, no, you can now. As of today, some of the subways have opened, but they're a bit far from where I live. So about half an hour walking there. Then I've seen photographs and tweets and Facebook posts about how many people are there at each of those subway stations because there's so few operating. So hundreds, if not thousands, of people at each of those. So you probably just a nightmare. So instead, just working from home, it just seems a lot easier. And I'm in a much better position than other people in my company. Three of them don't have electricity in their houses. They all live, one lives in New Jersey, one lives in Long Island, and then another one lives in the city in East Village. All three of them don't have electricity. And my co-founder, Jason, he can't even get into Hoboken. So he's lives in Hoboken, which is, I'm sure you may or may not have heard, is probably one of the worst affected areas in terms of waterlogging. So there hasn't been any electricity there for the last 3-4 days, and National Guard had to finally come in there and sort of try and make the situation normal. So he can't even get into his house.
Wow, that's horrible. Yeah, it sounds like a really tough situation for a lot of people. I heard about that with kind of the haves and have-nots, like almost two cities, one with electricity and one without. And I heard that people were walking from kind of the southern part of Manhattan and walking all the way up to, I guess, whatever that line is, up to like 40th Street. And I guess one of the Chase banks was open for people to come in and, I guess, use the bathroom and charge their phones. And it's funny how interesting, you know, what people consider to be, you know, their necessities. You know,
yeah,
people might have, and they could stock, I mean, you could stock up on water, you could stock up on food, but I guess it's hard to stock up on electricity. And if you need to charge, you know, your phone or whatever to just have some kind of connection to the outside world, it's interesting how important that is for people now.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the biggest things, I guess, is people trying to figure out where to get electricity to charge their phones, because, of course, there's the point about it becoming part of our lives, but it's also the only lifeline for a lot of people to the world outside. So that's the way there, because there's no electricity, so they can't watch TV, radio. A lot of people are rediscovering radio, I guess. And then, of course, internet, which they can only access for, in a lot of cases, through their phones and stuff if they don't have electricity at their house. So I guess we're going to talk about it with our guest today.
Yeah, I mean, you know, today is, you know, this edition of the Media Chwitz was supposed to be about the politics and the election coming up in just 4 days. But just like the political campaigns, you know, we were kind of preempted a little bit by the Hurricane Sandy, the superstorm, and just the damage that it caused. It kind of suspended the political campaigns, and it kind of is also, you know, changing our programming for the podcast. We're going to talk to Caitlin Thompson from WNYC, the public radio channel in New York, and also Corey Hike from the Washington Post to talk about their efforts around Sandy. We'll also have them talk about the coming election and what their plans are as far as kind of live coverage of Election Day. And we'll also bring in Aaron Smith from Pew Internet, as well as Tom Lee from Sunlight Labs to talk about their efforts. Aaron will give us some numbers and research that Pew has done around the way people are getting political news. And Tom will talk about some of the efforts that Sunlight does around transparency.
This is famous minor television personality John Hodgman. You're listening to The Media Twits with Mark Glazer and Rafat Ali.
So first, let's talk about coping with Hurricane Sandy online. When Superstorm Sandy hit the Northeast a few days ago, it brought 50-plus deaths and millions left without power due to damaging winds and catastrophic floods in its wake. But thanks to the power of Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Flickr, and so many other online outlets, some people were still able to connect during and after the storm. Our guests are Caitlin Thompson, WNYC's political editor, who runs its interactive politics website, It's a Free Country. Caitlin covered the 2006 and 2008 elections for the WashingtonPost.com and Time.com. Welcome, Caitlin.
Hey there.
We also have Corey Hike, who's the executive producer of digital news at the Washington Post. Corey has spent the last decade managing the disruption of web publishing, which she likes. From producing content to managing people and products, from reporting to editing, she's done it all. Welcome, Corey.
Thank you.
So, Corey, at the Washington Post, how did everything shake down as far as what you did online to kind of cover this hurricane, this major storm? We knew it was coming, but we didn't, you know for sure what was going to happen. What did you guys do online, and how did it differ from previous disasters or storms that came through?
Yeah, I think that the interesting thing is that we've been doing a lot of hyper live sort of coverage because we're preparing for the election, obviously. And sort of with the rush of conventions through debates, we've just sort of built an infrastructure around live in a new way. And that really had us framed up to cover this event, namely, The Grid, which is our sort of primary social vehicle for sort of aggregating content across social and presenting that in what I like to think is a very beautiful and engaging way. So curating tweets, Instagrams, just from across the social sphere, and presenting that next to live blog headlines and then video. And in this case, we used the Google tracking map, which we thought was really great. The crisis map, we swapped to that sort of in the heat of things because it was so useful. But we really had a framework set, and also I would say the live blogging piece is key. And we built that this summer and folks are trained. And so we sort of pulled the teams around these platforms that we had and sort of waited for things and were engaged and kind of moved along with what we thought was happening.
As everything happened, what did you have to kind of change on the fly? Were there things that you had planned that you just had to change on the go?
I think it was more a matter of scale. I mean, you know, the Washington Post is interesting in that it's a regional newspaper, and it's also a national and international site, digital across digital products. So we sort of had two audiences to care about in that way, there was really a potential for extreme destruction in the Washington region. So we had to cover it like a local story, as if it could have happened here. So really preparing our local desks for, you know, covering your normal sort of, you know, storm story in a local way, power outage, you know, tell people what to do, how to prepare for a storm. The biggest piece of that was very much a mobile story. And I should say that's also a different piece for us. You know, we watched our mobile traffic just you know, instantly turn into double what it normally is, which is a great thing. And that was another part of the infrastructure piece that we got ready for, you know, around the election. So we launched a new mobile website ahead of the conventions. I'm a strong believer in the mobile web, and that all web will eventually be mobile web. And we saw that. So for a local story, you know, letting people get everything they needed on the phone, on mobile web, was key. And we did a lot of that. Tips, you know, don't forget this, what to do if your power goes out, how to follow breaking news on Twitter if you're, you know, if you're a situation without, you know, real sort of internet, how you can follow it via SMS. That was one of our most popular posts, by the way, socially.
And Caitlin, you're on the ground in New York at WNYC. I know you guys lean very heavily on mapping. There's a lot of kind of transit maps and things like that. How did it play out for you guys? I mean, you were really literally in the eye of the storm while you were trying to cover it.
Right. And I think that actually gave us an advantage in the sense that, you know, just as a lot of the things that Corey just talked about, you know, having to sort of walk a balance between regional and national, we have a different balance to strike, which is that, you know, we're usually trying to sort of engender the New York conversation and beyond. But in this case, you know, the national news was in our backyard. And I think what we learned a lot from our hurricane coverage last year, since this is the second year in a row that New York has been inundated, although obviously this year is far worse, we were able to anticipate a lot about what people were going to be wanting to understand and know. And so, you know, a lot of the similar things to what Corey was just saying, crowdsourcing, using images, getting YouTube videos up, we took a Storify approach to most of our Sandy coverage this year because it was a really good way to have instantaneous and centrally located a convergence of coverage. And then the other thing that is really sort of unique and wonderful, I think, about radio is that, you know, as we've seen this week, it's often the only source of news for folks who have no power. And so being able to connect people who are just listening to us on the radio with our digital efforts and keeping that as a way to update people constantly, having the radio and the conversations happening on there inform our digital coverage became a very sort of dual front operation.
This is Rafat. One of the things that sort of come big in the last few days is trying to verify, of course, in such an uncertain situation as this, you as much as everybody else in the media industry are getting thrown a lot of information, whether through social or through other sources. What were some of the lessons there, and did you think that it was just an abnormal amount of sort of fake stuff which was floating around, or do you think this is just par of course going ahead?
I think in terms of, it's funny because when you talk to folks who have been in the radio business for a long time, having misreports and callers who come in, who call in and say something breathless is nothing new. And I think that they, you know, hosts and reporters are very used to having to give caveats and verify and verify and verify. And I think for us, yeah, we did see, you know, I think the big story today, which is Thursday, that, you know, Comfortably Smug was one of the biggest perpetrators of fake tweets going around and misinformation, was actually debunked rather quickly because I think of the sort of level-headed conversation that for the most part has prevailed in this coverage. And, you know, I don't think that we necessarily had much to do with that particular example, but I do think it's a good illustration of the way that in a breaking news situation, folks who are used to doing things live can teach those of us who are digitally now able to communicate instantaneously in live blogs, in live chats, tweeting live, and can really learn from. And I think that that made all of us better and more, both better and also more responsible about how we talk to our audience. And even now we're doing the same thing. We're updating the story now is turning into a transit and gas availability story. And a lot of folks are asking us to spread the word and to answer their questions about how to get around or how to get gas. And we're trying to take a pretty conservative approach, making the information as we can know it and verify it available, but at the same time, not trying to overpromise or become, you know, purveyors of misinformation, because it's very dicey when you start getting into the business of speculation and unconfirmed reports.
Well, let's pivot now. If you guys don't mind hanging with us, we'll talk a little bit more about Election Day that's coming up. The hurricane definitely kind of threw a wrench into, you know, both the presidential campaigns and also a lot of news organizations that were kind of had been following the election so closely and had to kind of change and preempt that with kind of coverage of the hurricane and now with kind of the repercussions and the recovery. Let's talk more about the election and social media. As Election Day approaches, we can look back at the long campaign for president and how big a role the digital media and social media played. We can also look forward to Tuesday and the role of technology in spreading memes, getting out the vote, and helping activists organize for Election Day. Joining us are Aaron Smith, Senior Research Specialist with Pew Internet, where his primary areas of research include the role of the internet in the political process, technology and civic life, and online engagement with government. He's also authored research on mobile internet usage and the role of the internet in family life and demographic trends in technology adoption. Welcome, Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Tom Lee, who's the director of Sunlight Labs, division of Sunlight charged with building technology to make government data more useful to the public. Tom has worked on government transparency in a variety of ways, from coding projects like Alina's Inbox to testifying on automated document declassification at the National Archives to consulting with the legislature on federal data quality issues. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
So, Aaron, why don't you set the stage for us? How has this election differed from past elections when it comes to social media and people using online and mobile sources?
Sure. So I'm going to highlight three things here that we really see as very different between the data we collected in 2008 and 2012. So the first thing, looking specifically at social media, the first big change that we've seen is that there are just a heck of a lot more people using sites such as Facebook and Twitter than there were as recently as the last presidential election. So between 2008 and 2012, the number of Facebook users has roughly doubled. The number of people who use Twitter has more than tripled. And so when we look at the campaign as a whole, about 2 out of every 5 Americans has taken some sort of action involving a political or social issue on a social networking site this campaign season. The second big change that we've seen is that as the social networking audience has grown bigger, it's grown to more closely resemble the online population as a whole. So in 2008, young adults were very much the dominant group on social networking sites. And as a result, the debate on social networking sites was very much dominated by those young adults who tended to skew heavily towards Democratic politicians and specifically President Obama. Today, what we see is that the social media universe is much more demographically balanced. And so as a result of that, the differences between Democrats and Republicans or between liberals and conservatives are much smaller than they were in the last election cycle. And the third big trend that we've seen when it comes to the news environment is that television news, which has largely held on to its audience, even as print and radio audiences have been declining, television may be losing ground a little bit with the next generation of news consumers. So when you look at young adults in the sort of 18 to 29 age group, the proportion of those folks who say that they watch television news on the previous day has fallen pretty dramatically since 2006. And among that age group, As many of those folks get news on a typical day from social networking sites as get news from television sources. And overall, the percentage of Americans who say that they get news or news headlines from social networking sites has doubled since as recently as 2010. So we've seen quite a bit of changes in terms of both who's using these sites as well as how they're using them specifically in the context of political and social issues.
Well, it's interesting, especially because the campaigns spend so much money on TV, and while they are on social networks and while they are online with their websites and mobile and everything else, they don't really spend a lot of money there. So it's kind of interesting that they're not necessarily keeping up with the way that the shift in people online are going.
Yeah, and so, you know, there's sort of two issues there. Certainly, television is still the dominant source where people get campaign news. So while we're seeing some fraying at the younger end of the spectrum, certainly for people, you know, over the age of about 30 or 40 or so, television still really dominates. You know, there also may be some issues where, you know, people in the mobile space and the social media space, you can sort of outsource this to your supporters and spend a little less time, you know, buying ads and so forth, and allow as a campaign your supporters to kind of take the lead on some of these issues. But certainly it'll be interesting to see, you know, over the next several election cycles, how this progresses and whether this is a long-term trend among the younger cohorts, if we'll see more of a movement towards increased spending on, you know, on social media at the expense of television advertisements.
And Tom, tell us more about what you guys are doing at Sunlight. You're at Sunlight Labs. I know you guys do a lot of work around transparency, and with the election and the debates and everything, you talk about kind of the influence of money, and now we have super PACs and kind of, you know, some nonprofits that are being involved, and it's hard to really track where all the money comes from. What are you guys doing to help around that?
Right. So you're absolutely right. Our focus on transparency leads us to build a lot of things that are more about the process of governance, but money in politics is a huge part of what we do. And it's such a rapidly evolving field that there are a number of different ways that we try to tackle it. I would say our flagship effort in this area is a website called Influence Explorer, which can give you basically a snapshot of the industries and corporations and lobbyists and donors who are trying to get the ear of the people who represent you. So this is a good sort of like big picture view of the landscape. But we also have a lot of efforts to engage more directly with the day in, day out disclosures related to this stuff within the election. One of the most useful, I think, is followtheunlimitedmoney.org, which tracks disclosures from the Federal Election Commission on a daily basis. You can see all the disclosed outside spending tracked by the super PAC that's doing the spending and by overall races. Of course, there's a lot of what we call dark money, money that's being spent by nonprofits in particular, where we don't know the exact contours of who's giving that money and buying influence or where it's going. But we are trying to pick up the threads where possible to figure out how those flows of money are forming. We've got an effort called Political Ad Sleuth, which takes advantage of a recent change in policy at the FCC. So each TV station in the U.S. has to maintain a public file that anyone can come in and inspect about who's been buying advertising. And recently, the FCC mandated that the top 50 markets, the stations within them, start posting this stuff online. Now, it's not in, you know, a very easy to search format, so we're asking for help from reporters and the public to help digitize it more thoroughly. But we do offer tools at politicaladsleuth.com that can help you do a quick search across markets or kind of get a big picture view. And then finally, I'd say that probably the most fun tool that we've debuted this cycle is also an attempt to help people understand the forces behind these increasingly poorly disclosed ads. It's a project we call Ad Hoc, like the bird, H-A-W-K. And you can find it in either the iOS App Store or the Google Play Android Store. And it's kind of like SoundHound or Shazam, if you're familiar with either of those products. Basically, when an ad comes on TV, you can capture a little bit of audio, and it'll use the fingerprint that it calculates from that to match against our database of thousands of ads that we've collected from YouTube and other sources, and which we've connected to the campaign finance information underlying it. So you can see who's paid for this and really what they're trying to achieve.
Corey, I guess this is for you guys, the Washington Post. I guess the biggest question is, how are you guys preparing for November 6th and I guess 7th as well? And I mean, because this is Super Bowl for you guys, I guess, 20 times over.
Yeah, exactly. So before I was talking a lot about the grid, which is sort of our primary live platform that we feel like really displays social, aggregates, curates social, and then also pulls in our live blog and offers video. So that's one offering, and that's really sort of going to be our social platform. But you know, something else that I feel really good about, and I talked a little bit about the mobile piece when we were talking about Sandy and how important that is to us. We're working on a geo-targeted mobile offering for Election Day. So really taking advantage of the ability to give people personalized information based on location if they opt in. And so you'll see that roll out in our results offerings via our mobile web. So that's a piece of it. And that'll be a small piece of the map that we're working on that's already live on our site, but a very robust offering, real focus on live. So live results, I mean, as they're coming, we're going to be giving you those across platforms. So heavy on social, heavy on all of our mobile offerings. Something else, though, that we care a lot about, because we're going to do our, you know, our traditional sort of, you know, reporting in the moment, and then also that analysis, but trying to do a real instant analysis piece to differentiate. So we're going to be really focusing on that and offering that in a new way, which I think is going to be key. And video. Video's very important to us at the Post. We're investing there, as you could see if you, you know, come to our site any given time of day and across our platforms.
And Caitlin, what about at WNYC in New York? How obviously you'll have some reports coming in on radio. You'll do a lot online. How do you think this election will differ from past coverage that you guys have done?
Well, it's interesting because listening to Corey describe the Washington Post experience, I have had that experience, and I spent 2008 at Time.com. And so actually one of the things that's so wonderful about those organizations is that they have, you know, virtually a dream team of analysts and reporters, all of whom are, you know, incredibly well experienced and read in and can do a lot of that analysis. Our approach has to be different. We're small and we have a very different sort of brand sort of responsibility. And I think digitally our efforts really go hand in hand with what we're trying to be like on the radio, which is understanding that we need to work with, you know, NPR, which is our, you know, sort of umbrella parent type organization. But at the same time, we have the ability to sort of put a lot of voice into things. And I mean that both sort of figuratively and literally. Our efforts have mainly been focused on sending our small batch of reporters out to talk to swing voters and get really, really deep, interesting profiles. We're trying to do it as smart as we can by matching up demographic data, finding, for example, you know, the not only the soccer moms in Colorado, but the soccer moms in this specific county who are maybe, you know, in a service worker center, but also on the margin of a more wealthy enclave. And so really trying to drill down on the types of people we can come back to, cultivate, talk to you over and over again, who are going to illustrate this story for not only our listeners, but for the rest of the country. And I, one of the things that I think I'm most proud of is both digitally and on air, we've been able to create a network of swing state radio stations that have been live tweeting, live blogging, live chatting with us on each of these sort of culminating nights, all through the debates, all through the primary nights, and basically tried to make up for what we lack in sort of manpower with what we can really excel with in terms of community.
And Aaron, you know, we noticed, Rafat and I talked about this during the debates, that, you know, you'd see people, you know, it was a lot more enjoyable to have Twitter running at the same time. And I'm wondering if on Election Day, you know, what kind of trends are you seeing as far as how people deal with getting information on a live kind of event like this? Is it watch TV, listen to radio, have Twitter on, text people? I mean, is this going to be a multi-screen experience for people, do you think?
Yeah, I think the answer is all of the above. So we've done some general research on this and found that more than half of all cell owners have used their phones recently to interact in one way or another with televised content. When we look specifically at the debates, about 1 in 10 debate watchers said that they followed the debate on their TV as well as on their computer or mobile device. And when you look at people in their 20s and 30s, about 20% of those folks were dual screen debate watchers, and 1 in 10 said that they followed that coverage exclusively on their cell phone or some sort of other mobile device. So I think we'll certainly be looking at that platform and time shifting, as well as, you know, people following things in real time and interacting with content and with the people that they know and trust in real time using their mobile devices, you know, all throughout Election Day, from the moment they vote, all through the evening when the results start coming in.
Hey, Tom, you know, with Sunlight, do you guys have plans for something you're going to be doing over Election Day? Will there be a transparency aspect to what's going on Election Day for you guys?
You know, we're trying to get a few things up and running, but it's in particular, we want to keep an eye on what's going on with how election results are disclosed. And we happen to have an awful lot of endorsement data that on hand that we've researched that we're hoping to expose to an interface that folks will find useful. But I think our focus is more going to be on analysis of how money shaped this election in its aftermath. That's what we're really gearing up to do. I am really excited, though, about some of the technology that's being brought to bear on Election Day in the process of going to the polls. I think the folks at Google for their Civic Information API, also the Pew's Voting Information Project, they deserve huge rounds of applause for this incredibly difficult task that they're tackling of trying to standardize ballot information and polling place data. Right now, this stuff is really just spread all over the place and in a huge mess of different formats. It tends to only be finalized in the last week or two before an election, so getting it into a unified shape that's easily reusable is a Herculean task. And then the actual election results themselves, pretty much the Associated Press is the only game in town. It's actually quite difficult to do good work with data around the process of Election Day. It's really, really tricky. We're cheered, I guess, to see that progress is being made by these projects and others.
Corey, one last question. I'm curious how you guys will deal with the big thing that comes up, it seems like, on these big election days is all the exit poll data and things that kind of leak online early and these rumors about this came out. And I know this has happened the last few elections. How will you deal with that kind of data and those kinds of leaks as they happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think going back again to the sort of hyper live mode and being able to sort those things and aggregate, make commentary around, have a conversation around things as they happen, sort of in a live blog format, will be our style around things as they happen. I like to say that we're going to have fast and accurate results on Election Day.
That's always hard.
Yeah, data experts on, you know, what we're calling our decision desk, they'll be calling races throughout the night. And we're going to rely on that decision desk to make the decision. We've done a run through, gotten the teams together, done a dry run with sort of stand-in decision desk and talked about the flow. And we know things are going to be coming in from all over the place. I mean, of course, you know, we're using AP as everyone is using AP, but making decisions based on what other sources are saying, but using our decision desk and our journalists there to make those final calls. But, you know, you can't deny, I mean, the world is flat digitally, right? You can't deny when things are out there. And so we're going to be paying attention and we'll be writing off those things as we see fit. I mean, we will not ignore the internet on election night, but we will rely on the decision desk to make the final call about what the Post says.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for joining us. We really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks. Absolutely.
And thanks, Aaron and Tom as well.
My pleasure.
Thank you. That was a pleasure.
Okay. Take care. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank my co-host, Rafat Ali, as well as our guests, Corey Hike, Caitlin Thompson, Aaron Smith, and Tom Lee. We want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation and our sponsor, USC Annenberg, for making this podcast possible. Be sure to check up on all the polls, news, and events at PBS MediaShift at pbs.org/MediaShift, including our Election Day live stream live chat coming up on Election Day between 1 and 5 p.m. Pacific Time.
Hater hates the world.